to local ecologically sustained
Portugal. You are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. Listen to Rootstock Radio every Monday at 5:30 on WEFT Community Radio. Coming up next is In the Know, a WEFT-produced public affairs show that highlights locally available resources. Stay with us after that for Champaign-Urbana Radio Theater at 7 o'clock, Monday night R&R at 8, live local music on Weft Sessions at 10, and recorded local music on Champaign Local 901 at 11. We're going to take care of a little underwriting, and then we're going to get into our show. The Urbanic Park District will hold its 50th annual Turkey Trot on Thanksgiving morning at the Lake House in Urbana's Crystal Lake Park. The one-mile run and walk is a great way to get a bit of exercise in before you sit down for a big meal. Check-in begins at 8 o'clock. The race kicks off at 9. And while the event is free, it is also the Park District's annual fundraiser for the Youth Scholarship Fund. Your generosity is appreciated. To learn more, visit urbanaparks.org. So you are now listening to In the Know. It is a locally produced radio show. It's a public affairs show where social issues, trending topics, relevant research, and important perspectives are discussed so you, the listener, can be in the know. The opinions expressed on this show are those of the guests and the host and not of WEFT. We're streaming live on my personal Facebook page. Listeners are welcome to submit comments and questions on the Facebook live stream or via Twitter at Nature79. Tonight, we're going to be talking about addiction, always a controversial topic, but definitely one that we need to start talking about because, as the president has acknowledged, this is now an epidemic. I have two guests in my studio this evening. If you guys want to go ahead and introduce yourselves.
My name is Jeffrey Evans, and I'm the department manager at Carl Addiction Recovery Center in Urbana. Been working there since 2005.
And my name is Tamara Kirby, and I'm an addictions therapist. I work at Champaign Treatment Center here in Champaign, Illinois. I have been working with Champaign Treatment Center since 2014. However, I've been in the field since 2009.
Great. Thanks for being on the show tonight. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as I mentioned, we have now acknowledged that addiction is something that we see in all areas. I don't think there's a demographic that's necessarily impacted more than another. But we have recognized that it's become an epidemic, especially the opioid crisis. We're seeing that now being the biggest issue. But to educate our listeners so that they understand completely what we're talking about, when we refer to opioids, what are we talking about?
Opioids are man-made synthetic opiates. So we're talking about anything from morphine to methadone to hydrocodone, Vicodin, Percocet, Demerol, hydromorphone. If we're talking about the natural plant-based opiate, we're talking about heroin.
Okay. Is there anything you wanted to add to that?
Nope, that's pretty much it.
Okay. So, you know, we've seen that, you know, it used to be that everybody thought heroin, that was it. You know, that was the crisis, that was the problem. But I think in recent years, we have seen prescription medications are now becoming just as prevalent when it comes to abuse and, you know, why do you think that's been a shift there? Or has it been a shift? Was it always a problem? We just didn't realize it? Or has it really shifted now where we see more with prescription medication?
Well, the problem has been around for many years. Mm-hmm. I started working at Carl Outpatient Treatment in 2005. And I would say starting in the later 2000s, like 2007, 8, 9, it's gotten progressively where we would get more and more patients that were reporting addiction to prescription medications, mm-hmm. narcotics. And part of that comes from back in the late 1990s, I think, the Joint Commission accreditation for American, you know, for hospitals and doctors, they made addressing pain as one of the fifth points of care, mm-hmm. just like they address hypertension and blood pressure, you know, things like that. So they made that one of the points, and they also lowered the prescribing abilities of certain tier narcotics. And it kind of gave way for doctors to be more freely prescribing like hydrocodone, Percocet, oxycodone, things like that, for pain where it maybe wasn't really needed, or the prescriptions lasted longer than they should have.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there was a lot more narcotics being flooded on the market, you know, for patients, and then those get into medicine cabinets, and then they get, you know, filtered in, you know, to other people abusing them.
Mm-hmm.
And then also we had, this was back probably in the early 2000s, where the clinics, pain clinics, as they called them, down in Florida, the strip mall pain clinics, were just like, you go in there and say you had back pain and you could get, you know, 120 oxycodone.
Oh, wow.
So, and they cracked down on that and they ended up closing those. But there's been a mindset of addressing pain in our medical professions, I think, too much with opiates. I mean, there's a time and a place, of course, with pain, of how to address pain, but it's kind of gotten out of control. And I think it got out of control before they could reel it back in. So there is a process now to start dealing with it within the medical community, but it's going to be a fight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, a lot of what people, how they educate themselves is with media or, you know, what TV shows and movies and even headlines say. And I think there's a lot of misconceptions that the media promotes with this, that, well, people are using or now, you know, now it is an issue, even though, like you've said, this has been an underlying problem for a very long time. But now who it's affecting, maybe, you know, making the call to action a little bit, you know, greater. There was a video that I tagged Tamara on my Facebook page that was talking about kind of the disparities when it comes to addiction, where the person who was, you know, speaking was basically saying, you know, if somebody gets caught with prescriptions or with, you know, drugs, it's different based on who you are. You know, the race plays an issue. But the comment that I made, you know, with Tamara was basically when this was an addiction to crack that, you know, Tyrone had in the 80s, mm-hmm. wasn't a problem then. But now you have white affluent, you know, soccer moms who are addicted to prescription medications. Well, then when that prescription isn't as easily available, now you see they're, you know, going to street drugs because they still need to be able to fill that addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's when some people are, it's a little eye opening to them, thinking, really, they're, you know, these people who normally wouldn't think would be the stereotypical addict, now you're seeing them, you know, having problems. So I think that's a big part of why we allocate different services and resources now, because we're seeing, you know, different people who are becoming addicts who previously weren't part of that stereotype.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think has really led to, you know, this being a crisis on the level that it is? I mean, you talked about how the medical field was just kind of letting this run rampant. Mm-hmm. There wasn't a whole lot of checks and balances. Do you think it's that we're acknowledging that the people are having an addiction with this? Do you think there's a higher death rate now with addiction? That's what's triggering this being seen as an epidemic? Because something had to, you know, the scales had to shift a little bit for people to realize this is now an epidemic versus what we've all always called the war on drugs.
I mean, I think in this country in particular, the amount of prescription medications that's being prescribed is a tremendous number.
Okay.
I mean, there is millions of people are being prescribed medications on a daily basis. So the sheer volume of people that are being addicted to prescription medications is probably greater than anything else.
Our country consumes 80% of the entire world's consumption of opiates.
That's
narcotics.
Crazy.
Yeah.
80%.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
And almost 100% of hydrocodone.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing.
That's a huge number that we're talking about. And I think that one of the common misconceptions that I hear from people that I treat on a regular basis is the thought that, well, my doctor prescribed it, so it can't be bad. It can't hurt.
Mm.
It can't harm me.
Okay.
Because my doctor prescribed it.
Right.
And so there's, you know, there is a level of trust that people have in their medical, in the prescribers, you know, that whatever they're prescribing me is going to be okay and this isn't going to hurt me.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth of the matter is that it only takes one round of prescriptions to get you going.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to get going within, you know, one prescription.
Well, I think people don't quite get that. Nobody ever uses, or I should say abuses, a prescription medication, thinking that they're eventually going to get addicted to not only that drug, but to heroin. Mm-hmm. Nobody ever says, has that mindset. I'm sure that's not even on the radar with them, mm-hmm. thinking that I'm going to develop an addiction from this. Mm-hmm. I don't think people realize both the psychological and the physiological pull that, you know, any drug can have. But that's, again, where, you know, like you say, you're hoping that your provider knows what they're doing, mm-hmm. and knows that this could be a possibility. You know, they understand that addiction could be down the road for this person. But, you know, again, if they're, you know, trying to prioritize pain management is one of the things that healthcare providers, you know, want to make sure they're doing well, mm-hmm. for their patient. I think there also has to be some due diligence on the other side of that for the provider as well.
Yeah, one thing that I have learned since I work at a hospital-based treatment program is oftentimes people will become physically dependent. Mm-hmm. Okay, so there could be a chronic pain condition where it's being managed through with the doctor and they're taking things as prescribed, but then they may notice over a period of time that they're dependent on that medication. And our medical director, whenever a patient is referred, say, from the pain clinic because of a potential addiction problem, if they have a chronic condition that requires narcotic pain medication, he'll always ask them, is the quality of your life better on the medication? Meaning, can you function and go about your life, or is it debilitating you?
Mm.
So if it's debilitating them, then that's a problem. Mm-hmm. If it means I can function normally or somewhat normally and deal with my pain, then, and they're taking it as prescribed, then it's managed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The other thing that we oftentimes think is like, oh no, if I take narcotics for, say, I have a surgical procedure and I'm taking hydrocodone for the next 2 weeks while I'm recuperating, then I'm going to become addicted.
Right.
Not necessarily so, and most people don't. In fact, most people that take prescription narcotics as prescribed for a short duration of period of time or whatever don't become addicted. We have this, you know, because of the epidemic now, sometimes we kind of like, oh no, if I take this, I'm going to become addicted. Mm. Well, there's got to be other things about that as far as genetic predisposition, mm-hmm. other vulnerabilities that may be part of that whole process. So don't think that everybody that takes narcotics is going to become addicted. Mm-hmm. But then that's what's happened with this epidemic, is because so many people, I think, as Tamara said, you know, take them, say the doctor prescribed it, he knows what he's doing. Mm-hmm. And then they start noticing, wow, if I don't have my 6 hydrocodone today, I start feeling sick,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so I'll take an extra one. Or they run out early, the mm-hmm. doctor ups their prescription, mm-hmm. possibly. So then the doctor says, oh no, I think they might be abusing this, I'm going to cut them off because mm. they're abusing this medication.
Right.
What are they going to do? Now they're addicted, so they have to keep from getting sick.
Mm-hmm.
So they either start buying pills on the street, or they go to the cheaper alternative of heroin because mm-hmm. they're taking so many pills.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a circular thing that that's what I've seen, at least in my, you know, where I work, that we've seen that kind of cycle happen.
Right.
Many, many times.
Well, and, you know, like you're saying, I don't think people actually recognize that by messing with their own dosage of medication, regardless of really what it is, you're putting yourself at risk, because you were prescribed an amount, you were prescribed a frequency for that amount. But if people recognize that they can get some type of high off of it, or, you know, they can feel a little bit better, even beyond just, like you said, pain management, I think people kind of play a little fast and loose with that. Again, never thinking that this is going to lead to any type of addiction. And that was just based on, you know, a conversation I had recently with a friend of mine who said that, you know, after they'd had a surgery, they recognized that they had up their own dosage, mm-hmm. where they went from taking it, I think they were prescribed it maybe every 10 hours to take one, and now they were taking 4 or 5, 6 a day, because mm-hmm. they liked the way that it made them feel. Never thinking that, again, they thought they had it under control, which is what most people think. Right. I have it under control. And then all of a sudden now, like you said, you've upped it, your body's used to that. When you're not giving it that, it's going to let you know, hey, we have a problem here. You know, mm-hmm. you're starting to have withdrawals. Mm-hmm. And I think people don't recognize that withdrawals really are serious. I mean, they are on a lot of different levels, but your body's letting you know, hey, this is, we need to feed this need right now, which is unfortunate that it can actually kind of domino into that area. Yeah, you were going to say something, Tamara?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, I've had clients that came in and said, I didn't even realize that I had a physical dependency on the substance until I was no longer able to get it. And then I just thought I was sick. I thought I had the flu. I didn't even know what was wrong with me.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. And explain that over and over. I've had people over and over tell me that. I wasn't even aware that I was going to become physically dependent, that when I stopped having these available to me that I got sick. I had the flu. I just thought I had the flu. But they were actually in withdrawal.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of crazy. Mm-hmm. You know, there's so much information out there on the internet about the dependency and the opioid crisis. One of the things that I saw was an article said that the number of kids and teens going to the ER with opioid addiction has increased.
It has.
It said researchers found that in 2013, nearly 50,000 ER patients aged 21 and younger were diagnosed with opioid dependence or addiction. And that was up from just over 32,200 in 2008. It said by that final year, roughly 135 kids were testing positive for opioid dependence each day in the nation's emergency departments. So we're saying this is not just adults who are having this issue. We're saying this is trickling down now. Why do you think we're seeing an increase with adolescents and youth?
Availability.
Pretty much. I mean, because when we were talking about that the freedom that doctors had to prescribe narcotics, you know, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, it's just expanded over time to where they're sitting in everybody's medicine cabinet, you know, and then when kids know, oh, okay, let's take some of these, you know, to a party or share with my friends or whatever, they start doing it. It becomes the drug that you know you can abuse or get high on without their knowledge that they're going to have a problem with this.
Mm-hmm.
And then you combine that with the availability and the inexpensiveness of heroin nowadays, and you got a catastrophe. Which is what we see, an epidemic.
So would you say that this is a kind of a literally across the map where we're seeing it in all the different regions of the country, or there's certain areas where we're seeing it more? I watched a very short documentary on Netflix called Heroin, and I can't remember exactly where it was. It was somewhere down south, but they were saying they had now become kind of the addiction capital for opioid problems. It was really interesting that the different, you know, emergency personnel that they were interviewing were talking about, you know, their response to it. This is not just pulling up to an emergency situation. Now you have all sorts of different, you know, dominoes that are falling. You know, and they showed some of the calls that they went out on where it's literally somebody who walked up. For instance, one of them was somebody who walked up to the counter at a fast food place and then just passed out. They were ODing at that point. They were even talking about how there were, you know, kind of your repeat offenders that they keep getting called out to. I mean, these are people they're continually going to wherever they are because they're ODing. But they also talked, they had scenes for drug court where the judge was saying, we're trying to help you. And she was, you know, really congratulating the ones who were sticking to their, you know, their addiction recovery. They were trying very hard to stay away from this, but then there were the ones who, you know, they kept going back, and she'd have to remind them, hey, you have young kids at home. You need to find your motivation to kick this and stay off of it. And I'm trying to be here as a judge for you to not only keep you out of jail, but to get you to the right services so you can continue and sustain your recovery. But they were saying, you know, this is just, there's so many, you know, facets of this, and there's so many parts of this that it's really hard to say there's going to be one approach that's going to work. But it was just interesting because they were saying, you know, we're this little town here in the South and we have such an issue. You wouldn't normally think that, I think is one of the comments somebody said. You would think it's like New York City. That's got to be the place where all the addiction is. And they were saying, no, we're talking about little town America is where we're seeing this growing.
We've definitely seen an increase in rural America. Around here, it's terrible. I mean, it's the rural communities and smaller towns are devastated with both narcotic and heroin addiction. But we've seen probably the coastal areas were the precursors. Seattle has been many years, has had a terrible heroin epidemic. Portland, Oregon. We know the East Coast, Vermont, New Hampshire,
Maine,
just terrible out there as well. And, you know, they're actively working on it. I don't know if it was Vermont, one of the states out there has a program that they've started. I can't recall exactly what it was, but it was a call to action because they were tired of waiting for federal government or whatever to step in. So they've started a process themselves with more effective case management, like you mentioned about Seattle, Tamara.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. You know,
why do you think we're seeing it in rural areas? Like what's been the shift that's put it there?
I think it's the prescription narcotics are the precursor to the problem. Because used to be in rural America, it was mainly probably alcohol and cannabis, use. And because of the availability of getting prescription narcotics and also just the availability of heroin, because we see many people coming over from, the Danville area. Oakwood, all the little towns around there are just, devastated, it seems to me. With addiction problems and lack of treatment accessibility in Danville, or not as much.
So you think that's also the counterpart to it? It's not only the access now is there, but the lack of access, once maybe somebody recognizes they need help, they're not actually able to get it, or it's not locally enough where they're able to get it.
That's part of it, I think, because sometimes transportation can be an issue. Money, not having insurance. Limitations to accessible Medicaid facilities, state-funded facilities, because they're all have waiting lists, just about any place in the state right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that when I did case management in the child welfare system, I actually had a lot of clients who, meth, heroin, a lot of different issues were going there, and there were wait lists for them to get, inpatient treatment, even outpatient, and all the while this family court case is ticking along without them getting the services that they need. Obviously, there's consideration made by the court, the state's attorney, the judge. We recognize you can't get in right now. Right. But I just remember one where it was just a revolving door of getting caught and then having to go in to, being kept in county. And that was the detox, was being in county because they couldn't post bail or post their bond or a variety of other reasons. Mm-hmm. But I remember sitting across from the parent and saying, when is enough enough? When are you going to decide that your child who you don't have, you haven't had for a very long time, is worth it for you to stop this? And the parent was visibly upset and was crying. But at one point, the parent just said, I don't know. I don't know how to do this. I don't know how to kick this. There's just nothing available, for me. I've tried to look into it myself. And then, I call places and they say, well, it's a 6-month wait, or it's longer than that. I think there is a counterpart to that too, where it's not just, addiction. I think there has to be sustainability with mental health services, where I think people don't realize how these two things go hand in hand. I mean, in the world of psychology, we have this, fun buzzword called, root problem. And I don't think people realize the severity and the seriousness that should go along with that, because these are root problems that are causing you to use in some way, shape, or form. It's not just the show Intervention on A&E where we're seeing this, clip of somebody's life and being able to say, oh, well, they were abused as a child. We get why. There's just so much more to it than that.
It's a complex disease because there's the behavioral part of addiction and there is the physical part of addiction.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we've got different pieces there. The physical part is what a heroin addict or a narcotic addict feels when they don't have the drug. Their body goes into withdrawal. And they're very, very sick, and they can hardly stand it. Same way with alcohol. I mean, alcohol causes withdrawal as well for those that are chronically addicted, and they can actually die from alcohol withdrawal, So you've got that, but then, yes, we have mental health conditions, dual diagnosis that is part of the problem. We have social exposure. We have a history of family abuse or neglect or dysfunction that can be part of it. There's so many complex pieces, but to treat the person, you have to address both the physical part and the behavioral part. So you have to try to look at all elements. Mm-hmm. And that's where, Tamara and I, as addiction counselors, we're trained as addictions counselors, but we're social workers.
We are.
Because we're trying to address, all areas, that there's dual diagnosis stuff going on. There's bipolar, there's depression, there's a lot of trauma, that you get with patients that is pieces of the puzzle, but you can't go there too soon. You got to get them stable and clean. Mm-hmm. You don't want to open Pandora's box of trauma and processing of things like that, because that will likely throw them back
right
in.
Back.
Yeah.
Into yeah. addiction. Re-trigger.
And the other thing that I would like to touch on is the fact that, you know, we're treating a healthcare issue criminally, and we have been for years. I mean, the fact that it's not being treated like the issue that it is. It's a healthcare issue. Addiction is a healthcare issue. It's been defined in the Journal of Medicine as an addiction, you know, for many, many, many years.
Decades.
Mm-hmm. Decades, yes. And so the fact that we're still treating it primarily criminally, even though there's behaviors, right, that are criminal, but that, you know, that we're locking people up and that we're just continuing to give them legal consequence after legal consequence, and we're not dealing with the problem. I mean, we have prisons filled with addicts, filled.
That's the number one treatment facility in the country is the U.S. prison system.
That's
wow.
right.
Wow. Yeah. That's kind of disheartening.
And they're not getting, and so when they get out, nothing's been done. Mm-hmm. Nothing's been treated. They haven't been treated. Their underlying issues haven't been treated. They come out and they go right back. And it's just a cycle that continues over and over and over again. And we're not putting enough funding and time and energy into treating the problem.
Mm-hmm. So rehabilitation, employment opportunities. I mean, that's why people go back, because you get out of jail with a felony, out
and
of incarceration, you're not going to get a job.
Yeah.
Right.
You're not going to get a job. And what are you going to do? I mean, if you're African American in this country and you have a felony and you get out of prison, what are you going to do to make
right.
money?
Right.
What are you going to do? You're going to go back and sell drugs.
Right.
If that's what you were doing beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
So we're just perpetuating it. We're not helping it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, and like you said, it's not even just making it part of your business. If you're using also, I mean, you haven't learned the coping skills to not go back to that behavior.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have any, you know, support to sustain you. And there's also plenty of stigma as it is with seeking mental health services. Mm-hmm. You know, how... It's kind of funny. I saw a video that I posted. I probably posted it a bunch of times now, but it says, you know, if we said the same things to people who have mental health problems, you know, we don't say those to people who have healthcare problems. You don't
right.
say, well, if you would just try this or if you would just do this. I mean, it's the same with addiction.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a different, you know.
What do you mean you're not taking your insulin for your diabetes?
Right.
Right.
I was going to say
right.
diabetes is what we commonly, you know.
Well, and
I'm not managing it, therefore I'm not going to treat you.
Yeah. I think that's a big part of why we don't see sustainable efforts anywhere, especially from our federal government, is because there's this mindset that, well, you should be able to pull yourself up by your bootstraps and, you know, figure this out. But if you don't
we
have,
can fight our brain.
Right, yeah. But you wouldn't tell that to somebody who's diabetic. You wouldn't say, well, you don't necessarily need to have your insulin. You should be able to figure out another way around this. You would never say that to somebody
exactly.
who has that kind
and
of
And they
issue.
Don't just treat them with the insulin either. There's behavior changes that need to take
oh,
place,
yeah.
like exercise, diet.
Mm-hmm. You see,
I mean,
dietitians.
So they're treating them holistically, which is what needs to happen in addiction.
Right.
I will say more treatment facilities are moving in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
We do mindfulness. A lot of practice in mindfulness at our facility, and we try to do other types of relaxation therapies. So we include diet, exercise, spiritual aspects of recovery, and there's a lot of facilities doing that now that are doing the wholeness approach, which does help.
Well, I think that just speaks to the idea that it's not a one-size-fits-all. I mean, psychology is not a one-size-fits-all, but we also see healthcare is also not necessarily one size fits all. I mean, there's, you know, going back to the idea of diabetes, you can treat with insulin, but there are still other things that you might recommend to that patient to help them, you know, exercise better, or maybe this type of exercise is better for you than this type of exercise. So, you know, being able to treat addiction the same way, you know, that it seems like a no-brainer that you should be doing that as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's disheartening that you have to have that argument that this needs to be treated like healthcare, like a health, you know, a normal health issue, that you have to be able to apply resources and services, and you have to figure out a way to make sure that those are sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that, you know, I found a lot was this idea that now that fentanyl is on the scene, that's why we have an epidemic, where all of a sudden this introduction to this new drug, which I don't think is an introduction. I think it's been like everything else. It's been there for a while, but now we're seeing it. It's a little bit more prevalent. So I guess kind of dialing it back, what is fentanyl?
It's a powerful synthetic opioid, commonly used for very chronic pain conditions. It has a high addictive potential. The most common that I know of is either used in the hospital, like through an IV or something, for a procedure, or the Duragesic patch, the fentanyl patches. But what we're seeing now is a lot of this fentanyl is being manufactured in underground laboratories, synthesized, and coming from overseas, maybe China. And we're also seeing car fentanyl, which is like animal fentanyl for an elephant. So, and we're finding it being mixed with heroin. So just by the nature of addiction, which, you know, is characterized by tolerance over time to the drug, needing more of it to get the same effect. Well, when a heroin addict, you know, is doing $100 worth of heroin a day and they can't sustain that habit, well, if there's fentanyl mixed in that heroin, they can probably use less heroin, but then they're running the risk of overdosing and dying.
Oh, wow.
Because they don't realize the power of what they're getting, and it's not FDA approved.
Yeah, I saw, I think, one of the articles I read that said it's 50 times more potent.
50 to 100 times more, more potent than morphine.
Carfentanyl is like 100,000 times more.
Oh, wow. I mean,
so
it's,
one of my friends works for, is a, works at the university, and she's a veterinarian, and so she works with dogs that are trained to sniff out drugs. And one of the things that is happening right now with carfentanyl out on the scene is that the drugs will go, the dogs will go into a building, drugs, you know, sniffing dogs, and they will die because it takes like a speck of carfentanyl. Because it, I mean, it's used to put into a dart gun to put an elephant down.
Oh, man.
So the amount in a dart to put an elephant down is being, so, I mean, people could die.
Yeah.
People die, dogs die. I mean, it's really bad.
And, well, and that's the problem. We're having so much, we don't know what's coming in. You don't know what you're getting sometimes. And I've actually had patients tell me that when they knew a friend of theirs died from an overdose, their first thought as an addict is, that must have been really good. I wonder where they got that.
Gosh. That's so crazy.
More that, bang for your buck.
The power of the addiction. Because they think they'll be smarter when they use it, and it won't happen to them. But the thought goes right into how high that person must have gotten from that.
That's just amazing that that's the first thought, though.
That's what they
It's not, you know, this is out on the streets. I wonder if, you know, I have access to it because I'm worried that I could have the same thing happen. It's, no, I wonder if it is on the streets and can I get access to it? That's kind of scary. I mean,
it's
I think that shows you that even the people who are using it, who probably have a better understanding of it than those who don't, but still are very limited in the scope of what they understand about the drug they're putting in their body. You know, you've seen other drugs that have come on the scene in the last several years where, again, people don't recognize everything that's going into it. I think if people understood what went into meth and if they understood what is going into their body, you know, how could you possibly put something like that into your body? And people just don't care. There was, I remember a very long time ago at a party I was at, somebody said that they had ketamine. And I thought,
horse tranquilizer.
What is, what on earth is ketamine? And then they explained to me what ketamine was. And I thought again, what are you doing? You know, you have no idea what this is going to do to a human. Only, you know, trained professionals know what it'll do to the actual intended, you know, patient for this, which, like you said, is would be a horse or a large animal, not a human who weighs considerably less anyways. And but it was kind of the same, you know, thought process. Well, let's just see what it'll do. This should be a good high. You know, if it's meant for something like this, just think of what it'll do for me. And that's kind of scary to think that there's no hindsight there at all. But again, you know, nobody ever takes anything thinking.
Especially when you're younger, because you're young and it means you don't have a sense of mortality. It's like, I can get through anything. I know I felt that way when I was younger. You know, you don't have that idea. However, when I was younger, I heroin was one thing that I thought, oh, that killed Janis Joplin and Jim Morrison. You know, I thought of all my rock heroes that died from heroin overdoses, and I was like, don't mess with that. So I did. I don't want to mess with any of that stuff. But it's there's a different attitude, and I think the internet plays a big part in how kids access what they think are is the smart way to take drugs, or what things will do and won't do. And so they're getting a lot of misinformation in some of the resources online. And then some of the others, just the old fashioned peer influence, availability, curiousness, you know?
So when we're talking about the cost, because I think that's, everybody just looks at the actual financial cost, but there are so many costs when it comes to addiction. You're, you know, losing out on so many different things. What are we looking at when we say cost of like emotional or psychological? What's the cost there to a person?
Ooh, you want to go with that one?
To the actual person using, what's the emotional cost? I mean, let's think about you know, a woman who is pregnant, who's stuck in active addiction, and can't get off the cycle, and knows that she's putting her unborn child in harm's way. So the guilt and the shame and the remorse that comes with that. I'm not sure that there is a cost. I mean, I don't know that you could, you know, put anything on that.
Quantify it.
I mean, the emotional cost is everyone that's the addict and everyone around them has an emotional cost. Families are devastated. Because especially if a parent doesn't know, why is my child doing this? I didn't raise them that way. And they can't control it. They can't. They didn't cause it. They can't cure it. That's the three C's we always say. So it's bewildering, and it just causes so much mistrust, anxiety, depression, fear. Just about any negative emotion you can think of is part of the emotional consequence of addiction for the addict themselves, as well as those that love them and those around them. So it's hard to measure that. It really, really is. And that's why recovery is so difficult for people, because the recovery process is learning to be honest with yourself and learning to forgive and learning to accept responsibility for the disease and how it's affected your life. And that takes a lot of humility and a lot of patience to be accountable and kind of go down, but then pull yourself back up. You know, and it's an emotional toll, the whole recovery process, especially early on.
And like you were saying, if these are emotions they're not willing to cope with yet, and it re-triggers them as they're actually going through the process of forgiving themselves, because I'm sure there is, once you're sober and you actually have clarity with your feelings, now you're seeing like the fallout of what you've been doing, how you've manipulated, how you've hurt everybody around you. You know,
That becomes overwhelming.
It does. Right, yeah, I bet. And I'm sure that could probably trigger you to go right back to using, because it's just too hard to be without that veil over you now, where the addiction was your veil, and now you're seeing beyond that veil and seeing everything that's happened. I had a friend, she was talking about how she, as a parent, felt guilt because she had enabled her child by providing, you know, a place for them to sleep, food for them, money, you know, which she knew exactly what the money was being used for. And so, you know, like you're saying, this fallout just extends to everybody in that circle. And so, again, you know, like when you see on the show Intervention, they want the family to get help.
Yes.
You know, it's not just about the addict going, yeah, they think everybody needs to learn a new normal, you know, figuring out how to cope on their own.
We always do that. Every assessment that comes in our office is, we say, if they're married, if they are younger and they have parents, family, if they have a significant other, whatever the situation is, whoever is close to that person and supportive of that person, we want them to be part of the recovery process. So our intensive outpatient treatment has two nights of the week that are family nights. We also have counselors that we'll see separate. Like if I'm seeing a patient, then the spouse or the significant other can see one of the other counselors. So it's definitely a best outcome is going to be when everybody's engaged in the recovery process.
Absolutely. I think addiction not only just affects the addict, but the whole family involved. And so it's important that, because if the addict is only getting better and the family isn't getting better, then sometimes the family doesn't know how to deal with the recovered person. And so it's really, really important to bring everybody together and move them along.
Absolutely.
So I think there's also, like you were saying, especially age can sometimes make people feel immortal, like this isn't going to happen to me. Or those who are veterans at using may also think that they always have control over their drug addiction and that they'll never OD. But even beyond OD, which is obviously the extreme, what are the physical costs that addiction to opioids? I mean, taking this kind of medication every day, I can't imagine is good for your body.
Well, heart problems mm-hmm. are part of it. Also, you have, if it's IV drug use, you've got HIV and hepatitis are common, as we know, sharing needles, mm-hmm. problems with that. Liver damage mm-hmm. because of the amount of Tylenol that's in hydrocodone, and taking large doses of that can be damaging to your liver. What else, Tamara?
I mean, we could go into STDs and, you know, HIV and I think there's issues with respiration because...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, respiratory distress.
Respiratory distress, for sure. And then, you know, you can't... especially for young people that are using opioids, it changes their brain chemistry forever. I mean, there's a change in the brain. So, you know, they need to be aware of that. I mean, I don't know that changes anything, but there is a change in brain chemistry, especially the younger that they are.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think people see that the overdoses, that's the only negative physical, you know, issue that I could experience. They don't recognize that, you know, using a prescription, because again, they feel like, well, it was prescribed to me by a medical professional. There's mm-hmm. no way it could do any type of damage to me internally. Mm-hmm. But like you said, we're talking about, you know, people who are using it maybe 2 weeks, maybe 4 weeks. We're not talking about chronic, you know, use where, again, I think there's that misconception that it's a prescription medication. How could it possibly hurt me? But mm-hmm. again, it's not prescribed forever. There's got to be a way to, you know, keep yourself healthy at the same time. You know, I had a friend who had a car accident, and they said, you probably will be using this for quite a while to maintain your pain. And his response was, how could I be on a medication that's this potent and this strong for a long period of time? Is it this going to, like you say, hurt some type of, you know, vital organ? Mm-hmm. And he said his provider was saying, well, we'll just manage that. We'll check things. But he still didn't have a lot of confidence in that, because he felt like the thought in his mind was, this is so close to heroin. How could this possibly be good for me to have in my body every single day?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One of the other things, as far as prescription narcotics, when you're talking about people taking them as prescribed, is if they've been doing that, they have no idea, like Tamara said, you know, that they're becoming addicted, and they mm-hmm. don't know until they stop taking it. The problem that comes in is in the withdrawal process, they start feeling, oh, I'm having pain again, because the anxiety, it's like there's a name for it and I can't think of it. Maybe you can know it, Tamara, but it's when there's a psychological connection to, it's not really that their pain is worse, but their sensitivity to pain is worse.
So there's like an emotional attachment to the pain.
Yes.
Yeah. And that happens right after they start taking it.
Mm-hmm. And so even though, let's say if I stub my toe and I yell out a curse word, mm-hmm. okay, because it hurt. But it goes away pretty quick because the endorphins in my body go right away and deal with that. Well, a person that's addicted, you know, that pain is going to be much greater mm-hmm. to them. Their sensation of something is going to be more intense. It triggers in the brain mm-hmm. their addictive behavior. Well, I won't say addictive behavior, the whole process of addiction in their memory system. It's all related. I don't know if this makes sense, but it's the perception of pain based on what the reality of that pain really is. Is the bar is much higher, you know, when you have a narcotic addiction.
Hmm.
So the fear the thing gets asked by patients oftentimes is, if they get clean, what's going to happen if I have surgery in the future?
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
And I have to take a medication based on the doctor's recommend or to control whatever pain. Like if you're in a car accident and broke your leg or something, you would have to take some medication, you know, for at least a short period of time, or they're going to give you morphine in the hospital to set your bone.
Right.
But that can be managed under the proper setting if that person is understanding their addiction, they're in recovery, they know what to do to deal with that. But it is a concern that people mm-hmm. have of that perception of a pain, that pain comes in and how they can relieve that pain
mm-hmm.
inappropriately, so to speak.
So, you know, again, when we're talking about cost, what do you think the cost is to society as a whole that we've had this increase in addiction. Because, you know, I've seen articles that say, like, the foster care system, for instance, we're seeing issues with that because you have parents who are addicted to, you know, opioids now. And so you're seeing children come into the system because their parents, usually not abuse but neglect, are not taking care of their children. There was one article out of Akron, Ohio. It said, according to Summit County Children's Services, the opioid crisis locally is presenting additional challenges to the tax levy supported agency. We forget there's children left behind in the wake of this epidemic. They added that it's difficult to show exactly how opioid addiction in particular has affected the agency, but as the region has seen increases in opioid addiction, overdoses, and deaths, the agency has also seen the number of children in care go up. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that part of society, obviously, we're seeing a cost to us socially.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. You know, I did pull up one survey against, you asked what the cost of addiction to society would be. So I pulled up a survey in 2008 from the Coalition Against Insurance Fraud. And in that year alone, they estimated $72 billion in just medical.
Oh, wow.
So
It's staggering.
It's staggering. So that's just medical.
Now, the combined costs of addiction in this country, I was looking at the National Institute on Drug Abuse website, which is a very reputable government website that we go to a lot. Their statistics, and I think this was several years old, maybe 2010 or something, was like over $450 billion it costs in combined with medical, insurance, lost productivity in work, just all areas that addiction affects our country. Mm-hmm. That was estimated at, I think it said $485 billion annually.
Wow.
And that was then. Mm. So you can imagine where the opiate crisis is, how much more impact it's having on our country.
So how do you see the drug industry playing a part in this? Because I know a lot of people, you know, say
pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah, yeah. Like big pharma is a big problem, and not just this area, but a lot of areas. But, you know, going back again to this idea that who's reigning what in? Who's in charge of that checks and balance when you have big pharma kind of focused on their bottom line? Yeah.
Do you want to get into that too much? You know, I feel that there needs to be more accountability mm-hmm. with the pharmaceutical industry. And, of course, I've always been against how politics work and the lobbying and the support of, these big corporations getting what they want. I think we had that in the news recently, and then we go back to when OxyContin came on the market. Mm-hmm. And that was marketed as a safe, effective, non-addictive.
Yes, less than 1%
is what they pain said. Medication.
Oh, wow.
And that was a lie. That was a down and out lie. And it also found that, you know, you could crush it and liquefy it and shoot it, and it was way better than heroin.
Mm.
So that just created sometimes they say that was part of the catalyst mm-hmm. of this epidemic. And that was, when was that? In the 90s when oxycodone came on the market. And then they reformulated it, but it's still out there, oxycodone.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that has been one of the culprits, I think, mm-hmm. of leading. But it's not just that, because it's then the loosening of prescribing of all narcotics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but that's kind of when they started seeing more problems.
And when did they start doing the prescription monitoring? That was just recently, right? In the last few years?
I think so, yeah. Because we do that at work. We will check any patient that comes in, and we always do that to check and see if they've been doctor shopping or
sure. Whatever. So before, there was no monitoring of that. So you could go to one doctor across town and then the other one and into the next town and get a prescription here, there, and everywhere. And no one was connected in knowing who was prescribing what.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there was just no balance in that. Who's prescribing what to whom?
Mm-hmm.
And now we can go in and mm-hmm. doctors can go in and find out who's prescribing what.
That's helping quite a bit.
It is. Mm-hmm. And they're also cutting back on how much they can prescribe.
Meaning how often or how much at a time? All of the above.
Well, I think because the CDC, Centers for Disease Control, a couple of years ago came out with some guidelines, because as it started, you know, a few years ago, it started the buzz about all the problems with narcotics in our society. And CDC actually came up with guidelines for doctors, for prescribing guidelines, and also how to screen for potential addiction. Because you think about the way medicine and healthcare is today, doctors don't have a lot of time with patients. You know, it's like a 15-minute appointment or something. And oftentimes some of those doctors don't have much training on screening for addiction as well. So they're asking the patient the questions. Yes, I have neck pain. Okay, here's, you know, 60 hydrocodone. They're on their way. But do they really go into asking more questions about potential addiction problems? Do you feel when you run out that you're not feeling yourself, you know, or do you find that you're thinking about, preoccupying about the next time you take your pill? So there's a lot of things that doctors could be screening more to monitor patients that would help, I think.
So it sounds like that is one of the solutions that we can use to address this. What are other, because you won't probably see this, we're just not going to prescribe opioids anymore.
No, then we don't want that to happen.
Right,
right.
Because
there's a place.
They have their time and place, and they're necessary. I had a kidney stone removed a couple of years ago, and that was not pleasant. They removed it the unfortunate way. So, when I got out of there, it was painful. And they gave me Norco, okay? And I took it as prescribed for the first couple of days. And because of what I do as a professional, I was like, okay, I don't want to take this much, you know? So I didn't take it and to see how I felt. And then I said, okay, let's take ibuprofen. And I was fine. I think for a few more days, I took it at night because I had a stent in there. And it was painful at night laying down. But then after less than a week, I didn't even take any more because just the knowing what I do and just, you know. So I don't want people to get that mindset that like, oh, I have to deal with chronic pain because I don't want to become addicted to narcotics.
Right.
Definitely you don't want to have that irrational fear.
But I definitely think there could be additional education for medical professionals regarding addiction.
Absolutely.
I mean, I can give you an example from, my family. My daughter had her wisdom teeth removed in high school. We have a family history of addiction. When we went in for the pre-appointment, we talked about options for pain relief after having her wisdom teeth removed. I specifically told them, you know, this is an issue in our family. We would, prefer not having that prescribed and trying an alternative route. We walked out of that surgery with a 30-day supply, 90 pills of Norcos.
Oh, wow.
After I had specifically told them.
See, oftentimes you can tell them something.
Yeah.
And they'll still prescribe it to you. Well, here's the prescription, you know, and they'll give it to you anyway.
You
and
can manage it yourself.
I mean, so they don't, sometimes doctors don't listen, I think.
Yeah.
But that's, I don't want to give any doctors bad names because there's a lot of great doctors out there.
There are. I'm just saying that, you know, if you're going in there and you know your stuff and you're providing them with information, you know, having them hear you is helpful. Not all doctors are like that.
And oh, absolutely.
That was just one experience. We've not had that many experiences, but I think it's important also as an adult to, know what your doctor is prescribing you.
We teach that. It's one of the things that we try to teach all our patients when they come in, especially with prescription narcotics or heroin, but alcohol or cocaine or any other substance, because the three classifications that people need to be aware of that could be prescribed are stimulants like Adderall, Ritalin, things like that, benzodiazepines like Xanax, Valium, Ativan, and narcotics. So we try to teach them what they are, what their generic names are, what their brand names are. We have a printout sheet, which I recommend people go to NIDA, N-I-D-A, the site, and you can print out a checklist of various medications and their potential harm and educate yourself. So if you go to the doctor and they say they're going to prescribe you Xanax and you say, well, that's a benzodiazepine. I don't know if I really want that because that's another class that is getting abused a lot too. Because doctors, especially mental health professionals, will overprescribe benzodiazepines for anxiety. And so we see addiction problems with that as well, or abuse.
Yeah, I mean, one of the solutions, it says, you know, prescription drug monitoring programs is, you know, a big part of the solution. It also says on the treatment side, experts stress the importance of having treatment readily available for those who are already addicted. Often that means going to where the people are and not waiting for them to seek out treatment themselves. And addiction treatment doesn't just mean counseling or an inpatient clinic. Studies show the most effective treatment for opioid addiction often requires, you know, other medications like methadone. And so I think, like we were talking about earlier, that access piece is incredibly important because if they don't have access, you know, that for all the good that we talk about education or, you know, prevention, once we're on the other side of that, if we don't have access available, we're still kind of dead in the water. So, you know, when people are wondering how they can get involved to push for, you know, better access, are we talking about, you know, talking to elected officials and saying the federal government needs to prioritize this now where we open it up to people who either have, you know, limited in insurance or no insurance, or do we just keep going like we do now where the only people who really have great access are the ones who have private insurance?
Well, it's always good to pressure your local representatives. You know, I mean, that's something, if it's a priority and you're seeing this, which I think it's happening more. As you said, the demographic is changing to where it's middle class, upper class, all demographic areas are being affected by the opiate epidemic. So pressure from there. Also being able to recognize what's available in your community. You know, we have some resources in our community, both medication-assisted therapy as well as behavioral, and a lot in the region too. But as far as access to greater care, there's going to have to be some major push like they're talking about in Washington with federal dollars being used to help with the epidemic. So that could be medication therapies or just access to behavioral health, which is usually the combination works best.
Sure.
Right. And so just to give a shout out to your agencies, if anybody's looking for help, just remind everybody where they can seek help. Like, for instance, Carl Addiction Recovery.
Carl Addiction Recovery is outpatient in Urbana. It's about 3 blocks east of the hospital. And we do medication assisted therapy. We have dual diagnosis, psychiatric nurse practitioner there. Dr. Hill is our medical director. Wonderful, wonderful addictionologist.
Good therapy. He's definitely a wealth of knowledge, that's for sure.
He is. we're lucky to have him in our community. But we got Prairie Center. And?
Champaign Treatment Center, and we're a medication-assisted program. We do outpatient adult treatment. We actually, you don't have to have insurance to come to us.
Okay.
So,
And we have Rosecrans.
And Rosecrans as well. We're located in West Champaign off of Country Fair Drive.
All right. Well, thank you guys for being on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Know, this is obviously, like I say on all my shows, just the tip of the iceberg. Addiction is obviously a huge, huge, huge beast all of its own. So we'll be having more discussions on this. Thank you to the listeners for tuning in to In the Know on WEFT 90.1. Tonight's show will be archived on RadioFreeAmerica.com, my personal Facebook page, and on Tumblr at In the Know 217. Next week, we're going to be discussing food insecurity, kind of giving you a glimpse at what that looks like nationally as well as locally and how you can get involved to help our youth here who are experiencing that. But again, thanks guys for being on the show. Hope to have more conversations about this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
As I am, together we cry.